Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Anne Maureen Oliver, and she's going to be talking about a book that's just come out called The Road to Martyr Square, A Journey into the World of the Suicide Bomber. And probably better than any book I've read or anyone I've talked to, this book goes into the mindset of the people living in the Palestinian area and the Gaza Strip, in the Palestinian area and living in Jerusalem itself. Their attitude and, of course, the various components within the Palestinian movement. Why they want to die, why are they willing to die, why are they willing to give their life to kill Jewish people. It's a tremendous opportunity to read the book, because it's written by a woman who was there, who lived in the Gaza area for a time, who lived in Jerusalem, who lived there. How long were you over there, Anne-Marie?
6 years. So, in the area.
And, of course, you spent a lot of time just talking about the graffiti. And you got to know an awful lot of the Palestinians, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, Paul and I, the co-author of the book, Paul Steinberg and I, were there, and we basically talked with anybody who would speak with us, which got us entree into all kinds of worlds. You know, Stanley, we didn't go there to write a book on suicide bombers. We were there before the advent of the Intifada, and certainly before the advent of suicide bombers. So I think this is one thing that really differentiates our book from other books out there, the sheer fact that we didn't go there to write a book about suicide bombers.
In fact, you went there to teach, didn't you? To teach.
Well, yes. A guy was starting a school in the Gaza Strip, and he was something of a Luftmensch. He's actually a very close friend of ours, a blind man and a musician. And the school just never materialized. So we began to just, like I said, talk to anybody who would talk with us, and we were particularly interested in Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, as it's called, which we kind of tracked from the very beginnings. In fact, the first part of the book is something of an introduction to Gaza, and it's also something of a political biography of the leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who was assassinated fairly recently by the Israelis. And so, you know, we started tracking Hamas and talking with anybody who would talk with us. And you mentioned the graffiti. You know, people here in America, they might get the wrong idea when they hear graffiti. You know, you were in the middle of a war, the middle of a revolution, and you were taking pictures of graffiti. You have to understand that graffiti covered every square inch of the walls. It was even written on cactuses and stones and cars. It was everywhere.
Yeah, but, of course, it reflected the feelings of the people. It's, these people were filled with anger and hatred and frustration. And really, that's really what you're trying to bring out, isn't it?
Well, it's a study of scripts, and by that we mean, you know, the filmic metaphor, a kind of ready-made program for thought, behavior, and action, you know, and scripts, as we know, are particularly important to adolescents, and these were very adolescent scripts. And so, you know, when people are uncertain as to what to do, they turn to scripts. At the beginning of Intifada, people had no idea what was an Intifada. What were they expected to do?
Well, hold on.
Graffiti told them what to do.
Hold that thought here for just a moment.
Sure.
We'll be back in just a moment as we bring some other stations on. We lose some stations, and then shortly we'll have everybody back together to hear the story of the road to Martyr Square. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Anne Marie Oliver, who, with a friend, lived over in the Palestinian section of the Holy Land for, what, 6 or 8 years, was it?
6 years.
For 6 years. And, of course, they were there before the Infidada, before the this movement took hold. And, of course, she takes you into the background of the various movements. There wasn't one movement. There were several movements there, and there were different leaders. There was, of course, the Hamas, which was basically Islamic fundamentalism. And then there were the sort of the nationalists behind Arafat. And then the conflict between the two groups. And as you pointed out in one place, which I thought was fascinating, there are many people there that actually believe that the Israelis actually helped to fund Hamas initially. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. I mean, the Israelis saw Hamas as, you know, a counter-movement to Fatah, their longtime enemy, the nationalist. And so they, you know, at the very least, they turned a blind eye to the activities of, you know, the early leaders of Hamas and the precursors of Hamas. I mean, you know, Hamas was created in 1988 or so, at least that's when they went back, or Covenant was released, but it goes back to a very old organization in the Arab world, which was founded by a man in Egypt called Hassan al-Banna. This goes back to, say, the late 20s. So, you know, the Hamas is not a new movement. It's simply the Palestinian wing of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood was really the one organization that was really coordinating this whole radical Islamic movement, other than, of course, the Wahhabi movement within that was within Saudi Arabia. But the Muslim Brotherhood really had spread out, but it never really had much strength up until about, what, the 1980s.
In Palestine, yes, the late 80s, they created Hamas as the so-called spearhead of Islam in the territories, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And they produced in I think it was August 1988, a covenant for the movement. What's interesting about this covenant is it provided something that really Fatah and the nationalist groups, like the kind of Marxist groups, PFLP and the DFLP, did something these groups had not done. What it did is it provided people with a complete program for life. If you look at the Mithaq, it outlines everything from blue jeans to jihad, you know, the role of women in the quote, liberation battle, unquote, to the last days.
And so
every single aspect of life is taking care of you. And that's why we talk about scripts, you know, in the book, and the importance of scripts in determining thought and action in life.
Well, I think what it was so interesting to me is that the nationalists were Marxists, communists, and just Palestinian nationalists. But hold that thought, we'll be with you in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Anne Marie Oliver, and we're talking about her book that she wrote along with Paul Steinberg entitled The Road to Martyrs Square. The Road to Martyrs Square. It is a fascinating analysis of what goes on in Palestine, and we're talking about, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood had been a radical Islamic movement going back to the Muslim Brotherhood in about 1928 in Egypt, but suddenly it comes into the Palestinian area, and before that you had your nationalist movement, your Palestinian liberation movement. But now, starting about 1988, you have a new movement, and a new movement with a religious fervor that had never been there before, and that would call upon people to kill themselves and to send their children to be killed and to train them to be killed and to die. And this put a whole different complexion on the movement, didn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, you had kind of precursors to this and the idea of a fedayi, a self-sacrificer in the nationalist movements. So it wasn't completely unheard of. In the case of suicide bombers, what changed is that you went out and you knew you were going to die, and you were prepared to die. And so, you know, there are many commonly cited motivations for suicide bombers. There's the occupation, there's a grievance, there's revenge, there's sacrifice, there's glory, nationalism, power, paradise, money. I think a large number of these ingredients had to be there for the idea of a suicide bomber to take hold. And I think probably one of the most important motivations is glory. Every adolescent wants to be a hero. And the scripts that are offered up to you to be a hero are ones of violent death and martyrdom and jihad. You're going to seize on those. And that's, in fact, one of our major ideas in this book, is that, you know, these scripts did not just appear during the Intifada. They're actually very, very old. They go back to the Palestinian revolts of 36, 1948, the 60s. Some of them go back to the Ottoman Empire. Some of them, we have graffiti in our collection that are hundreds of years old. What adolescents and youth did during Intifada is they took these slogans and these scripts that had been around for, like I said, sometimes hundreds of years, and they literalized them. And, you know, literalism is a very powerful, subversive strategy. And by literalism, you know, I'm from the South. So much of language is metaphoric. When people take what should be metaphoric and they literalize it, then there are all kinds of things that go into play. You know, if we're sitting eating dinner and there's a plate of chicken between us and there's one piece of chicken left on the plate, and I say, you know, your name is on it, you say, oh no, you must have it. And I take the piece of chicken without another word. This is kind of literalism of the sort I'm talking about. I've actually broken the rules here, because this should really go on, this back and forth, until we say, why don't we have it, right? So this is what we mean by literalism. Every religion has within it the possibility for violence. Every person has the potentiality for violence. Every culture has a high potentiality for violence. And this is what has to be fought against rather than given into. These scripts allowed youth to not only give in to violence, but to actualize it in the real world and thus become heroes through this very process of literalization.
And, of course, as you point out, this was not simply boys. This was even girls. They were becoming, what a wonderful way to become a martyr and to live on, because you would be honored and the people would continue talking about you. And you were a very, very special person if you died killing Jews.
Yes, you had embodied the whole idea of sacrifice, either for the homeland or for Allah or for both. Actually, it came more and more to that point. I don't think you can overestimate here what we can call the movie star factor. You were a suicide bomber in Palestinian society. You were something of a movie star, if not a sex symbol. And this aspect of glory and self-mythologization and collective mythologization was central. Quite central.
Well, now, because you had an opportunity to talk to an awful lot of Palestinians, did you ever talk to any of the suicide bombers?
Well, actually, in part three of the book, we focus on one cell of Hamas suicide bombers, three guys who are going to go out and blow up an Israeli bus, which is capable of holding, you know, 80 people. And
they want to kill as many as possible or maim them.
Yes, the whole idea is not, you know, people call suicide bombers. And we use the term in the book, but there's a huge homicidal element here, because, as you know, suicide is forbidden, strictly forbidden in Islam. You are not to bring destruction upon yourself by your own hand. And so this stricture, I think, was gotten around to some degree by the fact that you were to go out and you were to take with you into death as many of the enemy as possible. And this is what these people did. That's getting around, I think, the stricture against suicide. So there, you know, there's a strong homicidal element here, which can't be divorced from the suicidal element.
But if there's this total lack of concern for your own life. I mean, this is what's so hard for the average American living in our cloistered society to grasp, is that these people really want to die. They're looking forward to death. This, of course, is going to take them immediately to paradise. They're convinced.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole process, as would be apropos for adolescents, was erotized. Death was erotized. You know, the guy with whom we spoke who survived the suicide bombing, the last night these guys spent together, they talked about nothing but the virgins of paradise. So the whole process was erotized. The martyr was presented as a bridegroom. Upon his death, once arriving in paradise, he would receive 72 virgins. There were all the old mourning and martyrdom songs, which are kind of highly erotic in nature anyway. These were applied to the martyr. The process was erotized. And what did this do? What did this erotization do? It made people, it made heaven seem more familiar to people than it might otherwise. And, you know, in American society, the same process is at work. With any new phenomenon, it has to be kind of erotized. We do it with everything from credit cards to TVs. And so this made the whole process of dying and entering another world much easier for people. It made paradise familiar to them. In fact, you know, this is the mark of religious totalitarianism, I think. You colonize an elsewhere, and that elsewhere begins to have the same kind of reality that life here on Earth has. So the sheer, people no longer believe in the sheer facticity of death, the sheer factualness of death, and that also makes it a lot easier, you know, to kill yourself on behalf of a cause of whatever sort.
And of course, this was a cause that people were willing to die for because of their intense hatred of the Jews, because of their feeling of injustice, because, of course, their life was really, really very meager there. You described the living conditions of so many of the people in Palestine. There were a few, of course, were quite well off and comfortable, but so many of them lived in what we would call abject poverty. My goodness, the social workers here would just go wild if they saw these homes as you described them. And you did such a beautiful job of describing them, I could almost imagine these homes that you were describing.
Right. Yes, but you know, Stanley, I don't think the poverty, although that is commonly cited by people as a cause for, you know, feelings of hatred, and it actually is a motivation for suicide bombers. I think it's very difficult to come up with a profile of a suicide bomber, but if you do, we don't try to do that. But if you did try to do that, you would find people in all kinds of ranks of life, in terms of financial, you know, capacity, in terms of education. And, you know, if you look at 9/11, that kind of blew away the whole idea that poverty was perhaps a major motivating factor, because a lot of those guys were actually very well off. So, you know, everything's relative, you know. Palestinians live next to Israel, which is, you know, a fairly advanced, economically prosperous country. And, you know, you look across the Green Line and, you know, why do they have this and I have this?
Of course,
so it's a very relative phenomenon, you know, the issue of poverty.
But of course, certainly the living conditions between the Palestinians and the Israelis, there was just no comparison at all, at least
right.
from your description of reading the book. And of course, you paint the picture of Arafat, this so-called leader, this great leader. And of course, the people are coming into him and saying, why are we so poor? Well, of course, he's salting away, you don't mention, I don't know whether you mentioned that, but he's salting away millions of dollars of the money that's been given for the Palestinian people that's to improve their way of life.
Right.
And their living standards, he's taking it all for himself.
Right. Well, in the last municipal elections that were held in Gaza, which people like myself found very disparaging, why? Because Hamas took 70% in those municipal elections. And this is for many reasons, and one of the reasons is the one you just cited, the nationalist organizations, particularly Arafat's organization, was completely corrupt. Hamas, on the other hand, offer people a huge array of social services. You know, every kind of service you can think of they offered people. So they offered them not only these services, but this complete program for life. It's not the promise of personal salvation, which is also very, very important. They offered them self-mythologization. People have to ask, what price am I willing to pay for self-mythologization? Thus, I always go back to one of the major motivating factors for a suicide bomber is being glory. It's very, very important, particularly for an adolescent.
And, of course, once they had died, well, then they would become part of this mythology, and everybody would remember their name and remember their sacrifice and how beautifully they died. And this was almost glorification of death. It's a fascinating, fascinating insight into how this works. But, of course, it's all tied up with their religious beliefs. And, you know, specifically, Hamas, in many instances, would be giving them the justification, now because, of course, of this belief, immediate paradise. We're going to be back in just a moment or two with Anne-Marie Oliver as we explore this, and then at the half hour we'll open up our program to your calls from out across America. Anne lived there, she knows how these people think, and a tremendous insight into the force we face today.
Book that will really help you. you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Kaur's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Kaur's book, A Road to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaur will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaur.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox, the fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine. But those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like the corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763. Or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done, get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today, 800-544-8927, 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap, it's a miracle.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Anne-Marie Oliver. Her book is The Road to Martyrs Square. And it gives you some insight into these Palestinians, many of them are very young people, who get swept up in this idea of becoming martyrs, of becoming suicide bombers. And, of course, even some of them are women. Now, this is totally contrary to, any sort of a rational approach from our point of view, but not from their point of view. Now, certainly you go a great deal into this, but how many of the martyrs would be coming from the more or less secular point of view, or would the majority of them be coming from Hamas and from the point of view of the Islamic point of view?
Well, during the first Intifada, almost all the suicide bombers were Islamists, belonging either to Hamas, primarily Hamas, and a few from the Islamic Jihad. During the second Intifada, what we had was we could call it an Islamification of the nationalist groups. so that the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade, which are a nationalist group, also began to carry out suicide bombings. So you had this back and forth. You had a kind of nationalization of the Islamic groups and an Islamification of the Islamist groups. But of those two movements back and forth, I would say it was the Islamification of the nationalist groups that was more important than the nationalization of the Islamists.
And this was basically then accepting this radical Islamic group belief, or at least we would feel it's radical. I'm sure many of the Muslims would feel that this was a return to the true teachings of the Prophet. Would that be a fair statement?
Look, these people take the word of God and they use it for their own purposes.
Right.
There are many scriptures in the Quran. 4:128, for instance, peace is better, right? They have chosen particular segments of the Quran for their own reasons, and they've literalized and actualized these scripts.
Yeah, but
the detriment of say, Quranic scriptures calling for sulha, or reconciliation, or for peace, salam. And this is typical of movements which want to justify certain things, and they use scripture to do so.
Well, now, of course, there was this crippled sheikh who was really sort of the dynamic force behind this for many years. Why don't you tell his story? Because I think it was so interesting that eventually he was actually released by the Israelis, and of course then he would even foment more in the way of violence. So why don't you tell that story?
Well, the first part of the book deals a lot with Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who he was the leader of Hamas. He was the main leader of Hamas. And he was killed fairly recently, as I mentioned before, by the Israelis with a missile. His story, we actually interviewed the Sheikh in his home in Gaza. And we had heard about him for months and months beforehand. He had attained mythic status long before we met him. He was paralyzed. He was a deeply ascetic individual who, didn't want anything to do with the material world. People treated him as a saint. In fact, we call part one Saint Yassin precisely for that reason. People treated him as a saint. We spoke with him. He was he was not direct at all. He spoke in apothegms and parables. And one of the few things he did say directly had to do with a tree called the Gharakad tree.
Would you pronounce that one more time?
Gharakad tree.
Okay.
All right? It's irreproducible in English. Now, this is a very interesting tree, and we spent a great deal of time trying to track down the meaning of this tree. The tree doesn't occur in the Quran. You could look forever, and you would never find it in the Quran. It occurs in a hadith, or an oral tradition of the Prophet, which was passed down by a transmitter named Bukhari. And it goes something like, the hour will not come, and by the hour I mean the last days, the hour will not come until the Muslims fight the Jews and the Muslims will kill the Jews. Until the Jews hide behind the trees and the rocks, and the trees and the rocks will say, O Muslim, O servant of Allah, here are the Jews, come and kill them, except the Gharakad tree, which is a tree of the Jews. That's the hadith.
And I really think it's so interesting that they believe in the last days. They believe that Jesus is going to be there in the last days. Of course, the trouble is he's going to become a Muslim or going to lead the Muslims at that time. But they look upon the Antichrist. You call him the one-eyed man. Was that right?
Yes. The Dajjal is the equivalent of the Christian idea of the Antichrist. And he's also called the great deceiver, the lying liar, the one-eyed man. He has a number of epithets attached to him. But you can see by this choice of holy words that the Sheikh seized upon, that actually the idea of the last days is very central to Hamas.
And of course, they look upon apocalyptic happenings coming very soon, as do many Christians. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Anne-Marie and Oliver, and we'll take your calls at 1-800-544-8922, 1-888-24-LIBERTY.
The Anglo-American establishment It gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who were actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and most people, a few people, have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a confession of faith, which was attached to his first five wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WART.
Sophisticated investors are buying gold and silver today because the dollar has lost almost 50% of its value in relationship to the euro, and the price of gold and silver has increased almost 40%. If you're interested in learning more about precious metal investing, why don't you call Bo at 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177, or visit him at Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop in downtown Santa Cruz at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building, which is located between Trader Joe's and the Signature Twin Movie Theater. Bo's telephone number is 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177. And he's located at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building. And if you mention you heard about Elliott Stamp and Coin Shop on Radio Liberty, why, you'll get a 15% discount on some non-investment items.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
And we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest this afternoon. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Anne Marie Oliver, who had lived in the Palestinian section of the Holy Land for 6 years, and was there before the first Intifada, and of course there during the second one as well. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. On the front of the desk cover of the book, there's a picture of a little boy. He doesn't look like he's more than, 7 or 8 years old. He's holding a pistol in his hand. He's being held overhead as an example. And, of course, you talk about how the mothers, of course, train their children, dress them up as if they were suicide bombers. This is something that children are being reared for from a very early age, which of course, is totally contrary. You would expect mothers would want to protect their children from the violence.
Well, I mean, we call this the cutification of death. And I think it's another way of pseudo-familiarizing people with paradise, so that no longer is one afraid of paradise, but welcomes it and thinks it's a wonderful thing, a wonderful fate. You know, ideas of paradise are culturally determined. What is paradise? Even for Christians, it's a counter life. It's an alternative meritocracy where one is going to get what one really deserves. On a spiritual level, you know, the spiritual fruits of what one has earned in life, even perhaps against the dictates of culture, or what the rest of culture says that one should be doing, this is when one is going to get what one really deserves. It's also a deferment. You know, paradise is also a deferment. And I think that's something that Americans, whether they're secular or religious, can understand on some level. I mean, the fact of the matter is that most of us are working double time today, barely You know, we hardly have time to do anything of any importance, spiritual or other, in order to enjoy some retirement on, you know, some golden love boat somewhere where we'll finally let down our very, very thin hair by that time. So, you know, these things are culturally determined. The thing of the children was particularly disturbing to a Westerner, yes, yes, in the schools, you know, one is taught about martyrdom on PA, that is a Palestinian Authority broadcast. There would be almost what you could call public service announcements where, you know, people would be beckoning other people to paradise. On the walls, people would be watching videotapes of the last will and testaments of suicide bombers. You know, messages would be being broadcast from muezzins. The whole culture was saturated with the idea of martyrdom, so that it would have taken somebody very, very strong to resist these calls. That's, you know, Hamas's propaganda arm is called Dawah, the call, a Dawah, the call. And, you know, these calls to death, these calls to paradise, these calls to a counter life were everywhere. Very difficult to resist them.
And, of course, this graffiti was all throughout the Palestinian area, but what about Jerusalem when you lived there? Was it in Jerusalem as well?
Sure. There was graffiti. In fact, that's where we first started recording graffiti. It was in the old city of Jerusalem where we lived. And, you know, if you were a researcher or a journalist in the area at that time, both sides offered you scripts. They're a different kind of script. And so we began to look at these messages on the walls as not only a kind of Arabic lesson, but also a different means of understanding the Intifada, because these messages weren't meant for outsiders. They constituted almost a purely internal code. They were meant for other Palestinians. So they offered a different entree into the world of Intifada that we learned a great deal about them. And of course, as the Intifada progressed, the media became increasingly sophisticated, so that by the end, you had videotapes featuring the last will and testaments of suicide bombers. And at the end of these tapes, you actually had coming attractions for more suicide bomber tapes, more martyr tapes, to use their terms. The whole process by the end was commodified. You could go into the souk, the marketplace of the old city of Jerusalem, and buy a plot with the appropriate Quranic scripture on there, most often Quran 3169, "Nay, do not think that the one who has died is dead. He is alive and well with his Lord," provided for. You know, and then you would just paste a photograph of your family's martyr in the blank spot, and you would hang it on your wall. So the whole process by the end was not only well known, but actually commodified.
And, of course, the thing was that this was almost the whole fixation of so many of the people there, you know, increasingly frustrated, angry, and, of course, whenever they had to carry out a terror attack, why, then the Jews would retaliate and there would be more hatred and bitterness on both sides. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. I mean, you had a situation of tit-for-tat violence, violent reciprocity. You know, we have a new project we're working on now, which I'm very excited about, because despite the suicide bombing, the terrible suicide bombing that occurred today in Tel Aviv at a discotheque, we're actually fairly hopeful about the future. I mean, there are a number of really good signs happening right now that are truly revolutionary. The Israelis, for their part, have agreed to stop any kind of, you know, incursions into the West Bank and Gaza. They've restricted them only to ticking bomb situations. They've done a number of goodwill gestures, like the release of Palestinian prisoners. The Palestinians, for their side, have also done a number of things. They've reintroduced the idea of impersonal rather than divine law. I think that's very important. They've talked about disarming militants. They obviously weren't successful.
They weren't successful.
But the suicide bombing today shows that they weren't successful.
Right, okay.
And it also says something about Hamas. Hamas, or whoever carried this out, it's being claimed by a number of factions, is obviously going to try to wreck this very fragile peace, one of the first opportunities we've seen in a long, long time. So our argument there would be that not only do they have to make these steps, but also the scripts have to change, right?
And of course,
people have to be offered other scripts. And I think also the very idea of peace has to be changed. Peace for most people, for a number of people, let's put it that way, is a very nebulous concept. It suggests stasis. It doesn't suggest transformation. It doesn't suggest power. It doesn't suggest glory for a large number of people. I think the whole idea of peace versus war and violent conflict, which has this attraction, obviously, for huge numbers of people, the whole idea of peace has to change. So we began a number of months ago a new project, which we hope will actually result in a film and a book. A completely different road. It's going to focus on people on both sides of the Green Line, that is, Israelis and Palestinians, who've either refused to carry out some sort of death sentence of one sort or another, or who've actively risked their lives to save a member of the opposing side. Radical empathy, rather than tit-for-tat violence. You know, so many researchers and journalists go over there and they focus on one thing. You know, it's either the leaders of these violent militant groups or, say, suicide bombers. That's why I emphasized at the beginning. We didn't go there to look at suicide bombers. It gave me no pleasure whatsoever to look at these people. We struggled for years in what to do with this historical materials, this huge archive of political ephemera and underground media of Intifada. What should we do with it? Despite the fact that it could be appropriated, misappropriated, what could we do about it? What should we do about it? You know? So we're very hopeful, despite, you know, the many problems ahead. The whole idea of peace has to change. People have to be given alternative scripts that are equally compelling to these violent scripts. They have to be equally compelling. They have to be equally romantic. They have to be equally appealing. And that's going to be a very difficult thing to do.
Well, I certainly agree with your basic tenet. But, you know, if they really believe that the Islamic scriptures talk about this apocalyptic time that is coming where the Muslims are called upon to kill the Jews, and, of course, the rocks and the trees will cry out and say, here is a Jew hiding, you're going to have to totally change their whole religious framework of thought. To change this attitude of wanting to kill the Jews, because certainly most of the leaders of this movement don't want to live in peace with the Jews. They want to drive them out of the Holy Land or kill them. Would that be a fair statement?
I'm afraid a number of people would really like to fulfill that fantasy. It has to be reduced back to a fantasy, you see, and the language has to be turned into language again. Language allows people to move. That's their whole point about literalization and literalism. It allows people no room to move. When the text says, you know, go out and kill X, you know, this is what happened with these last day scriptures with Hamas. You see, because that hadith which I cited before, if that remained on a metaphorical level, like so many other scriptures and many other religions, you know, you could interpret it in a number of ways.
Right.
What happened during the Intifada, it was literalized. Go out and kill a Jew. You're being morally and religiously sanctioned to do precisely this. There are many scriptures and many religions that if you literalize them, there would be huge chaos.
And of course,
horrible violence. In short, yes, the end of the world.
And
so the suicidal impulse, which I think is within a number of people and a number of cultures, has to be fought against. Adults can't relinquish responsibility to adolescent fantasies. What are adolescents? They don't know anything. They're in constant transformation. They're constantly confused. They have no idea what they are.
You know?
So it's very important what culture offers up to adolescents.
But, you know, we've seen videos of what's shown on Arab television over there to increase this desire to become a suicide bomber and encourage little kids, 7, 8, or 9 years of age, to join the Infantada and go out and kill a Jew. And you point out some of these graffiti or some of these posters that show this giant Arab, you know, and, of course, a giant Muslim, and, of course, all the Israelis cowering in front of him. And this is designed to give this feeling of almost invulnerability to the young people as they enter this suicide mode of life.
Yes, I think adolescents in general feel invulnerable and invincible. They don't understand the notion of death. They think of themselves as completely invulnerable. I can speak from experience. And when we were there, we were fairly young. Actually, I mean, we weren't that young, but, you know, adolescence kind of perpetually prolonged these days. And, you know, we were young and stupid. That's how we were able to do this project, quite frankly.
You must have been, I hate to say this, but as I read your book, these people must be crazy. I mean, you could have been killed at any time, Anne-Marie.
Well, I mean, like I said, it helped to be young and stupid. So this is the adolescent mindset. You never think it's going to be you. You have no concept of death, really.
Well, I think the Lord must have been looking after you then. That's the only reason you got out alive. Let's go to Herman calling us from Carmel. Hi, Herman.
Hi, just a quick question. Comment from our guest about the release of hundreds of Palestinian terrorists. Doesn't this just encourage them and embolden them more?
You could certainly argue that, and some people do. You know, the fact that, you know, when the Israelis exiled the leadership of Hamas in 1991 to the snowy slopes of Lebanon, trying to get rid of them, you know what happened? They were actually further radicalized by their contacts with Hezbollah. In fact, with the suicide bombing today in Tel Aviv, some people are saying it was Hezbollah. That was a huge mistake. You can hardly know what it is you're doing, but what I can say about the prison system is that it constitutes almost an initiation rite for Palestinians. There are huge structures within these prisons. People actually, you know, think about all kinds of things when they're in prison. They organize in prison. They're highly factionalized, highly organized places where people, I'm not sure that they're being prevented from furthering the organization in prison. So I'm not sure what good, I mean, certainly there should be some punishment, but I'm not sure that's the correct one. But yes, this is a problem. This is a problem. What is the best thing to do? It's like the exile of Hamas leadership in 1991, which the Israelis later obviously thought was a great mistake. You know, the problem here is that the two peoples are stuck in a place the size of a postage stamp, and they're going to be stuck there together forever. And you know, therefore, this is the importance of peace and the whole transformation of the idea of peace.
Herman, anything else you wanted to say?
Do you feel that if this doesn't change, that there's the possibility that in a future war that the Israelis might decide to wipe out the Palestinians?
No, I don't think it's possible. Nor morally desirable. I don't think that's in the cards whatsoever.
I certainly hope and pray that it isn't, because the Palestinians are good people, and certainly some of them would like to live in peace. The trouble is, if you are a Palestinian and want to live in peace, you're considered a collaborator, and they'll kill you. That is a tragedy. Did you run into that sort of thing?
Well, you know, the whole phenomenon of collaborators we talk about in the book, and there were a very large number of Israeli collaborators in the West Bank and Gaza, but some of these people were actually not collaborators. So, you know, there a kind of fervor swept over the society, and people who were morally questionable or just, you know, you couldn't really place them very well, that they became labeled as collaborators, and many of those people were killed. Women whose morality was questionable on some level, the term became a collaborator term. And it really wasn't very easy to tell who was a collaborator. And of course, given the situation, there was a huge amount of paranoia, so that huge numbers of people were thought of as collaborators. This is a horrible, horrible situation where paranoia just sweeps through the entirety of society, you know, and you don't know who you can trust any longer. Horrible problem.
It sure is. How much is your book? How much does your book sell for, do you know?
Well, it's $26, but you can get it various places for various prices.
All right.
You know, you can get it at Amazon.com, I think, for $17.16. You can get it for Barnes & Noble for $20.18. I have no idea as to why these huge differences in price.
Well, of course, so this is unfortunately the way things are, and so people are going to have to decide. But the book is called The Road to Martyrs Square. The Road to Martyrs Square is an excellent read. It gives you a tremendous insight into the thought process of some of the people that they met who said, you know, I would like to die. I mean, I'd like to die, you know, as a martyr. You have to understand how they think. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a fascinating program and fascinating insight.
And I'm just glad you got out of there alive.
Thank you, Stanley.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this afternoon's program.
Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam, in Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened at Oklahoma City, what really happened with TWA 800 on the route down off the eastern coast about a year ago? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts, entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working on the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, this book has been suppressed very effectively across America, and it's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book on there that will give you a more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is a fascinating book. We have a fascinating video. It's called The New Barbarians. Now, don't confuse that with another video we have called The New Order of the Barbarians. Of course, that's actually a four-tape set, but The New Barbarians is a film footage that is taken from Arab television stations and broadcast throughout the Arab world, specifically into Palestine or elsewhere, and how they are mobilizing and inflaming the hearts and souls of the Arabic people and the little children. You'll see them 7, 8, 9 years of age being trained to become terror bombers. And of course, television has a tremendous impact. This is the most amazing footage. It's actually taken from the Arabic television and put by Carol Matrician into one of the most gripping films you've ever seen. Then you'll see films of these young people, 16, 17, 18 years old, taking and capturing some Jews in a car and literally tearing them apart. I mean, the film footage is disheartening when you realize the evil that lurks in people's hearts, but you need to understand what we're up against. Now, who was it who funded this whole Islamic movement? Well, of course, the background of Hamas, which was radical Islam, funded by the Israelis. And who funded the Israelis? Why, your tax dollars. And those of you who have not yet seen that article we have out of the Washington Post, the ABCs of Jihad, how we financed the textbooks to encourage this, or read our other material, our newsletters, about how we indoctrinated the Mujahideen and this radical form of Islam to create a holy war, we've created the best enemies money could buy. But if you'd like to call and get the new Barbarians, 1-800-544-8927. Well, Dr. Stan, I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. It's not a nice program to think about these things, but this is the reality. And, of course, what is behind this whole Islamic movement? is Satanism. And if you don't believe that, you need to get our 4-tape set, Islam, the Religion of Doom. That's Islam, the Religion of Doom. We have a wonderful book called The Prophecy, Islam, the Prophet of Doom, or I think that's the title. Anyway, it's the Prophet of Doom. There's a book, there's a 4-tape set. That really will give you tremendous insight into this. And then, of course, we have the called Islam, the Prophet of Doom. Islam, the Prophet of Doom. So we hope that many of you will give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 to understand what's going on. We have a great 4-tape set. We have a book on this. It will give you an understanding of the Islamic faith and what we're up against now that we have rekindled in the hearts of the Muslim people this hatred of the West, this hatred of the Jews, and the desire to die in jihad. So, again, we do have a great video. It's called The New Barbarians. It's The New Barbarians, and it is film footage. It was actually taken off of Arab television, a gripping documentary put together by Carol Matriciana. So all of these are available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. But, of course, what energizes this whole thing is the occult. And, of course, that takes me to my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. We hope that some of you out there, we're almost three-quarters of the way to getting the number of cases sold that we need to do our major printing. If you'd like to get a full case of our book, ordinarily the book Brotherhood of Darkness sells for $12.95, but you can get a full case for $2 each or $124 for 62 copies, and you'll have to pay for the shipping on top of that, which is about $25. But here's a wonderful thing. You can sell the books. You can give them away. You can lend them. We hope that you'll lend them. Get people to read them, because this book has changed people's lives. When you really begin to understand what we are up against, and that is, of course, organized evil. So you get the case for $124. That's $2 a book, $124 for 62 books. And give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, because, of course, once we start printing the books, which won't be too long, why, we won't be able to make this offer again for a good long time, if we ever will. But we think it's an excellent means to get the book into your hands so you can get it into other people's hands. And, of course, at this time in history, the most important thing you can do is help us to educate the American people. Well, our telephone number, again, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we have so many other videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3, the 4, or the 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. And if you want to understand why Michael Jackson's in so much trouble, why you really want to see this video, goes into the background of Michael Jackson and where he gets his amazing talent from. And then you'll hear many of the other people there, quite frankly, talking about where they've got their talent from, why they are so prosperous, why they are multimillionaires. These are the people in the rock music. You need to get our videos, Megiddo 1 and Megiddo 2, which will give you the spiritual aspect of what's going on, very professionally done. And then, of course, my video, None Dare Call It Genocide, a relatively new video going into the fact that they're poisoning our children with mercury, and they know it's in the vaccines, and they're lying, and there's a tremendous effort right now. A massive propaganda machine is at work to convince you there's no relationship between the explosion of autism and the mercury in the vaccines, which, incidentally, they're still leaving in the vaccines. They want you and your children to take. It's in the influenza vaccine, I suspect it's going to be, and the new vaccine that's going to come out for the bird flu. And you're being propagandized and frightened into taking that when it comes out. Well, I want you to know I'm not going to take it. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again. May the Lord be with you.